It is Wednesday, December the 4th. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope that you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving, if you celebrate Thanksgiving. It was a fantastic holiday. I felt a little under the weather over the weekend, and I've got a little bit of a story, and I'm going to go into that here in a couple of minutes as we lead into today's interview. And today's interview is with Liz Wallenstein, and she is a TMS psychotherapist. She works remotely. She also works locally in Arizona, and so that's what today's interview is about. She's somebody who came out the other side of chronic pain, chronic illness, and pretty amazing story. We'll hear some of her methodology, and one of the things that really sticks out to me about her is that I see it as a almost like a no-nonsense, no-BS approach to it. I think it's unique, and it's something that I've had a lot of practitioners that have come on here and talked, and I feel like hers is just a little bit different. I think a lot of people are really going to enjoy it. Before I get too deep into today, wanted to make sure that I thank the patrons of the podcast. So patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast really are people that want to support the show in some kind of a monetary way. And so let me give a shout out to Jennifer, shout out to Jenny, shout out to Sean, Abigail, or sorry, not Abigail, Christina, Holly, Ross, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Alyssa, Brian, Adrian, Sarah, Stan, Kristen, Sarah, Helen, Barb, Arnie, and Kim. So thank you so much. These are people that have gone to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Patreon is a place for creators. So if you have a favorite podcast that you like, a YouTube show, internet radio show, there's a variety of different types of entertainment that are a part of the Patreon network, but really it's to put some kind of monetary amount forth to help keep the podcast on the air for free, help keep the YouTube show running. This does have associated costs with it. There's hard fixed costs such as publishing and equipment and things like that, but then also soft costs. What goes into setting up the interviews, doing the interviews, post-production, editing, all that stuff that goes into it. So I want to make sure I give a really big shout out to those people. So before we jump into this interview, I thought it'd be kind of a cool opportunity to tell a little bit of a story. So I was feeling very under the weather. I went to the gym. I did this workout on Thursday. CrossFit is kind of my main training domain. And so I did this workout, which was 32 minutes, but it was with a partner. And so, you know, give or take, I'm doing half the work and she's doing half the work. And normally in workouts, a lot of times, I don't usually let my heart rate get beyond, let's say, 88% or so. If I were wearing a heart rate monitor, that's about the max that I would go to. And a lot of times if I hit 88 or 90, I drop down to somewhere between 70 and 75 before I start going again. This is one of those times where normally when I would take a break, I actually would continue. So I didn't I hardly took any breaks. And it was pushing past, I sort of have this level where I'm kind of like, that's sort of my limit, my activity limit. And for whatever reason, I felt just inclined to push past that limit, which I know, like, we see a lot of Instagram memes and keep moving forward and all that kind of stuff is sort of the way of the world, and that's how we think everything should work, but it shouldn't always be like that. And especially, like, it's not a holiday workout, you know, I'm trying to enjoy my weekend off and things like that. So I really pushed far more forward than I normally would, and then I got home and I just felt like a bomb just hit me all of a sudden. I just felt a little nauseous. I felt a little queasy. I just didn't feel like myself. I laid in bed for a couple of hours. Just didn't feel. It just ugh. Just blah, blah, blah. And then it was even more interesting because I think it was Saturday. It was either Friday night or it was Saturday night. My left shoulder was just on fire. This is the same shoulder that I had surgery on almost 4 years ago now, and it was the front of my shoulder where my delt is was like on fire, burning delt, just everything hurt. My bicep felt like it was swollen. All the exact same symptoms that I had when I tore my labrum or when I had my shoulder surgery several years ago. And this was really the precipice into starting the whole TMS journey. It was this is where the walls really started to break. So my shoulder started imitating that exact same pain. And my mind went back to what I had done a day or two before at the gym. And I thought, oh no, like, is this like a delayed onset thing? Am I injured? That kind of thing. And I've been going through car shopping, and it's been kind of a stressful experience. And as I said on my Facebook page, I don't get a lot of joy out of this. Really, just the joy of car shopping to me is just test driving. I think that's really fun, but I really don't like the idea of dropping a ton of money and having another car payment and, you know, being, and I drive a ton for work. And so that's part of this is my MPG is not great. My car is not overly reliable in some ways. And so just out there shopping a little bit for something that accommodates my lifestyle with kids and dogs and driving a ton and being comfortable while I'm driving a ton. I drive 20 to 25,000 miles per year, which is a ton. That's a lot of driving. And so I just don't find it. I don't find it as like a fun activity. It's an anxiety ridden activity. And I thought back to what did I initially start feeling like? My shoulder was all jacked up. This was the end of October, October 31st, so Halloween of 2015. And I went back and I was searching in my email. When was the last time that I was negotiating via email about a car and kind of in a mad rush about switching cars? And I go back, October 31st, 2015, and the 5 to 6 to 7 days leading into that, I was negotiating hot and heavy with the exact same guy over another Subaru product. And I just thought it was really, really interesting. This was right before I went to bed. And then I went to bed. I woke up the next day. I had no shoulder pain, not even a hint of it. I haven't had a hint of it since. So just making those connections, I feel like, is so critical in your journeys as you kind of work through this stuff. So Liz and I talk a little bit about this kind of stuff, connections. And this interview was recorded weeks and weeks ago, so we don't get into the shoulder thing. But really, really fascinating. I think you're going to really dig her. You can find her online at LizWallensteinTherapy.com. That's LizWallensteinTherapy therapy.com. Again, she does these sessions over Skype. She's got a really killer story. And it's pretty amazing. I love having journeys like this, and it's even more powerful people that have come through chronic pain and then now make it a profession. I think it's even more powerful. So here is Liz Wallenstein. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. And ironically, today, the person that I'm interviewing has a last name spelled very similarly to mine, but pronounced differently. I'm here with Liz Wallenstein, who's a psychotherapist previously out of New York City, now working out of Phoenix, but still works with clients remotely. Are you there, Liz?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me. I got the opportunity to learn quite a bit about your backstory recently, and I'm excited to dive in to that kind of stuff. But I want to start with the most obvious thing because it's timely. And Julie Markowitz, who's a psychotherapist who I had on here a few weeks ago, she also made the plunge moving from New York to a different part of the country. So what's with you people?
Well, only somebody who hasn't been in New York for the past few winters would ask that. The truth is I married a Phoenician, and every time I came out here, I'm like, wow, it's really beautiful, and it's warm, and it was just getting hard to go back to New York after those visits. So I said, you know, let's do it. Let's try moving out there and seeing what it's like. I always wanted to be, you know, what a New Yorker would call an out-of-towner, be someplace where it's just more chill, more relaxed. And so far, so good. I miss the passion from New York, but it's nice being in a warm place that's peaceful.
Yeah, I could do. I Seattle is kind of like a miniature, like a really, really miniature New York. But the opposites definitely are there, because in Seattle, it's very passive aggressive. In New York, from what I understand, it's quite the opposite of that.
Oh, yes, definitely.
I guess the advantage that New York has is that it seems to be exactly what Gotham is portrayed as in all the Batman movies, which is kind of cool. I guess it's that, but I don't blame you. I'd never heard of Phoenician before. That's people that live in Phoenix, the Phoenicians.
Yes.
That's so funny. Seattleites is what's up here. I think that's what we call
really?
I think that's what
like
we call
that.
Us.
I never heard that.
Yeah, I think that's what we
Well, you guys, you know, you should come out here because you guys are getting all the rain that we don't get.
I'm an avid motorcycle rider, and it's kind of a bummer. I still ride all year here, but it would obviously be a lot nicer to. I don't want to be in Phoenix riding between like May and May and September. But in December, you know, a Christmas Eve ride when it's 75 degrees would be awesome.
Yeah, and the views. I can't get over the views. Like, you know, I asked my husband, are you seeing this? And he's like, I'm so used to it. I don't even notice it anymore. I'm like, that's such a shame. The views are gorgeous. As you're driving down a highway, it's unbelievable.
That's so cool. So you're a practicing psychotherapist now, which is, I think that makes even your, and I was thinking about this recently, is that I feel like a lot of the psychotherapists, when I talk to my wife, I refer to you guys as shrinks, and I know that's, maybe you like that, maybe you don't, but
I
say basically, it seems like the reason that a lot of these people get into this field specifically is because they were impacted by it, right? It's different than, I feel like it's different from people like me. If I get into technology sales, it's not because I had this amazing life event that caused me to say, hey, I, or wake up one day and say, hey, I want to be a sales guy. Right. you've got a hell of a story, and it began at 18 years old. And I'm sure that as you've gone back, it really began earlier than that. But
you're right.
But yeah. Let's start there. You at 18 years old, you had an event. You met somebody, and it seems like the rest of your world was really changed after that.
It actually started as a senior in high school, and it was the summer before I was going into my senior in high school, and I was having these really bad back pains, and I was telling my mom, and right before that, in that summer, I was working in a sleepaway camp, so they said, oh, it's probably, the camp mattresses, you'll be fine when you get home, and when I got home, it got worse. And, we did all the, routine stuff, got MRIs and, saw sports doctors, this, that, and nobody really could say anything. And this is where I say I had the advantage of youth because, it's very hard to pinpoint it to things when you're that young and say you have a slip disc, this or that. And what had happened was actually one of the people that I went to go see was a chiropractor. And I had mentioned that I had been in a car accident. Now, the car accident was after my pain had started already. So I knew it wasn't from that. But I don't know. He got all excited about that, said that's what it's from. It made it worse. And I used to go every week for an adjustment. And then they put you on this, massage roller bed. And I actually really liked the massage roller bed. It was very comfortable. But as soon as I would get in the car to go home from those appointments, my back would be killing me. I'd be in excruciating pain. So I was like, this doesn't make sense. I literally just walked out of the office. And also, it never sat well with me because I knew the pain started from before that.
Right.
So I was really, really desperate. And at the same time, my brother, who is 5 years older than me, he was actually, this is how a lot of people find Dr. Sarno, but he was reading Howard Stern's book. And in Howard Stern's book, he talks about, Dr. Sarno, and that, he was in excruciating pain. He could barely move. He used to do his radio shows from lying down on the floor. And Dr. Sarno changed his life. And so my brother tells me and my parents about this. And he said, what do we have to lose? And we had the advantage of, living in New York, that it wasn't hard to see him. And I think my mom called him up and he said, well, you may not even need to come see me. Just go get my book. And that already was pretty stunning that a doctor, I don't think they took insurance at the time. And, that the doctor would say, I'll forego the heavy fee you'd have to pay and just pay like 10 bucks or whatever to get my book.
Right.
And that was already your introduction to that. He was a pretty special guy. But so we got the book, but my parents were nervous anyway. So they booked an appointment, anyway for me to see him. But even already when I started reading the book, even though I was so young, I was really able to identify with a lot of what it was saying. And I actually felt like it, it was at that age when you're coming into yourself and you're learning who you are. And I felt like I was actually figuring myself out, like learning who I was by reading this book. And then I went to go see him anyway, and, he did his physical exam. He said that everything looked normal, and he told me to come to his class, which is, was standard for what he did at the time. And I was really nervous to go to the class because I thought, everybody's going to be so much older. I was going to be, a kid in there. And there was actually another teenage guy in there at the time. And basically, shortly after that and continuing just to read the book, I started to get better. And it was, just progressing and progressing. And then, over the years, there'd be some minor relapses, a couple of big ones. If you want, I can talk to you about what happened with that.
Well, I want to back up a little bit, and I feel like I know what you may say, but you go to these, you read the book and you go to the class or the lecture. Was there any aha moment there, or was it sort of the more that I learned about this stuff, when I first read the book, I thought that people will have an aha and really that's the end of it. And then I think that over time, it's this really much slower secretion into like your belief system as a whole. What side of the fence were you on at the time? If you can bring yourself back to then, what side of the fence were you on at the time?
So there's a couple of things I could say about that. I definitely had several aha moments, but I want to clarify what an aha moment is, because I definitely had certain like epiphanies where I realized something about myself, or I realized something about my life, or like a feeling really came to the surface and the pain would go away right away. Like that definitely happened. But I'll tell you, as a therapist who's doing this work, a lot of people come, I'm going to call it a misconception, like, because it comes from Sarno's earlier books. I know where like it comes from. I get why people come with it, but they come expecting that it's going to be this big revelation from their past, and then that's it, and everything's going to go away. I rarely, rarely, if ever, see that. There's not usually like this one big thing that if you uncover, you get better. But at the same time, I've definitely had moments of epiphanies where I'm like, oh, like, I can't believe, like, I didn't realize that, or this thing is really bothering me, or, and then, you know, like, let's say that relapse of pain would go away.
And the reason that I bring that up is that I've seen his, I don't know how close, have you ever watched the lecture that was released on VHS that is available on his former website? Have you ever seen that, like, the recorded one?
I'm not sure, because I've seen one on YouTube. If that was the one on YouTube,
it was probably that one. Yeah, I think somebody illegally uploaded it, but nevertheless, it was it was supposed to be the same thing as what people going in there would see. And there was a couple of times in there where he's drawing on the chalkboard. He's saying, you know, this stuff is below the surface and it's not going to come out. And to me, that's. But he said that maybe there was like one, I think that he had talked about this woman who had been sexually assaulted, and that was kind of like her aha moment. But it sounds like really hardly anybody will actually ever feel this stuff. That's why awareness and knowledge is the penicillin behind it. Is that correct?
I think everybody goes to that one example. I think that's the example he talks about in his book also, about the woman who had been sexually abused.
Yep.
But I do, you know, rarely see that. And a lot of times I tell, you know, my clients that, you know, Sarno, it's already been a bunch of years since Sarno stopped writing. And I mean, he passed away, but even before that. And if he was still working and writing today, he'd constantly be updating and revising these things. It's not that like what he said was wrong. It's just these things change. You know?
Yep. And I definitely, let's get into that in a little bit. What some of the changes that you, because the Divided Mind was the most recent release. I think that was 2012, and a lot of times passed between then and now. And I feel like a lot of this kind of stuff has now entered the laboratory. It's you know, it's being worked on and more rigorously researched with Dr. Howard Schubiner and some other people that are in the field. It sounds like that experience when you were a senior in high school and kind of went through that first cessation of the pain is kind of what led you into wanting to treat this stuff as a profession. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So, well, at first it started like, you know, when I was saying that I was learning about myself, like I didn't come from a family that was very emotional. I always thought like emotions were optional, like, you know, it wasn't for everybody necessarily. So, you know, just learning about my emotions and being tuned into them, was new for me. And so I would say that going through this process, it really enlightened me about like my inner world, my emotional world, the psyche even. And that already started me thinking about that I might want to be a therapist one day. And I'll tell you the truth, you know, when I was actually at that point in my life where I had to think about my career and, you know, choose if I was going to graduate school, and actually, especially once I graduated graduate school and it was about, okay, what am I going to focus on as a therapist? I was actually very intimidated to pursue, you know, being a TMS therapist. It could be pretty daunting because as a therapist, people are coming to you wanting to feel emotionally better. But as a TMS therapist, they want to feel emotionally better and physically better. And that scared me.
Yep.
And I actually went to go speak to Dr. Arlene Feinblatt, who's the therapist that worked, you know, alongside Sarno all those years, to talk to her about it. And, you know, I wanted to learn from her also what goes into being a TMS therapist. But yeah, so I would say that my experience definitely encouraged me to become a therapist in general. And then because I felt like, my life was so much better from having gone through this. I look at all the best things in my life right now, and I feel like I wouldn't have had them without, you know, Dr. Sorno coming into my life and all the things I learned about myself and the ways that I developed and the ways that I grew. And so to me, that whole experience of this worst thing in your life becoming one of the best thing in your life, I was like, wow, like if I could help other people have that experience, I want to be able to do that. And that's what made me, you know, pursue TMS therapy.
It's interesting that you went and talked to Dr. Feinblatt. I interviewed her as well as Dr. Eric Sherman. And it seemed to me, and this is just a sense that I got, she never said this or anything like that, but I almost feel like she was very cut and dry on the TMS thought, and her quote.
She's very funny.
Yeah, and that her quote in the All the Rage movie about Dr. Sarno was that all that we're really talking about are feelings, and if you allow yourself to feel as opposed to, you know, shutting it down or I don't want to think that or don't think that, don't think that. And to me, it's such a I'm involved in some of these like TMS groups and such on Facebook, and people I think dive so deep into all of it that they almost get lost in the whole thing, and maybe that's part of what's getting them stuck. And she really simplified it. Is that the same sense that you got in talking to her, to be like, hey, what is the difference between working with people that have TMS versus working with people that, you know, in traditional therapy?
Right. So one thing that, you know, it started, you know, learning it with her, and then I was networking with the other therapists who had worked with him for a while. And, you know, when people ask me, because I also do regular therapy in addition to TMS therapy, and when people ask me what the difference is, I think it really comes down to defenses, which are like personality structures. It's not necessarily, you know, this goes back to this idea that we talked about just a minute ago. It's not necessarily like things that happened to you in the past, but kind of a personality structure that has developed that can make, you know, make it more conducive to pain. And so her style of therapy is very, like, she cuts you off a lot, and it's very getting into the defenses. Like, I don't need to go into the story as much or the details of even the emotions, but more of just like, let's see how you work and, you know, the way that you function, the way your mind works, and let's see how that's contributing to the pain, you know?
Have you seen All the Rage?
Yes.
So there's that scene where she's in there with Michael Galinsky, and he's telling the story that is sad, but he's laughing, and she kept cutting him off and saying, why are you laughing? You're laughing. Like, that's totally what you're describing.
Typical session with her, yes.
and the way that you, I did this, I kind of had this, not necessarily, I won't call it an epiphany, but as we record this, I put my dog to sleep last week. And one of the things that I was thinking about that life really is in a lot of ways is kind of this collection. First of all, I think that victimization or victimhood is sort of synonymous with TMS. It's one really recurring theme that I seem to find in people in my life, but then people that I talk to that have kind of gone through a lot of this is that they have a lot of, I'm the victim. And I had thought about it in my own life that I've always really kind of had this very underdog playing from underneath. That's sort of my, and then my cop out can be if I don't succeed at something, oh, well, I was the underdog and that's, you know, that's just how it was. And it's kind of like the collection of life has really been things have happened to me as opposed to things just happen. And that's, you know, it is just the way it is. And the world keeps spinning and that's all that it is. And to me, it's almost kind of like that's what you're maybe sort of talking about in a way is what's the psyche of the person? How do they process events? Things like that.
Well, it's interesting. The example they're using with yourself, I would say you're actually on a healthier level. You're more in tune because what I'll see a lot, and maybe, you know, this was working in New York City for as long as I did, but there's people who are very out of touch with that. Like they overcompensate for that victim feeling. They're not in touch with feeling like a victim. And when you do the work, that's when they realize that they do. But they'll be like overachievers, perfectionists, you know, because they're trying to cover up that victim feeling. But yeah, I would say a lot of, you know, maybe instead of victim, I would use like a helpless feeling, or also just very stuck or very alone. But again, they may not realize that until they do some of the psychological work. But definitely, you know, what helps people recover a lot of times is a sense of empowerment, a sense of, you know, I can control things in my life, like in a positive way. I have a say over my life. Like, I feel like TMS patients often feel like at the like at the whim of another person. Like they're very reactive to others instead of feeling like, you know, their life is their own.
And at the mercy of everybody else.
Yes.
In every situation.
Yes.
So fast forward a couple of years from 18, then we get to something else that was pretty substantial in your life that we can relate or not relate to this kind of stuff. And when I was reading what you had written about what happened in your mid to late 30s, I started thinking about like Dr. Gabor Mate's books, which are a little heavy for me sometimes. But
yeah,
what happened in your mid to late 30s?
Well, I'll just, if I can go a little bit before that, actually, kind of in between, and then I'll get to that, was, you know, so I had basically become pain-free from that, you know, original onset, but every now and then I would have some, like, you know, relapses, and some were very minor, and some were pretty big, and this also goes into, like, kind of what inspired me to do this work was, I started to see a pattern of the big ones would be before, like I was on the verge of something really big and really great in my life. Like the next time I had a relapse was as a senior in college. And I went to go see Dr. Sarno again. And he's like, you know, are you not seeing this the first time you were a senior in high school, the next time you were a senior in college? But not only that, like, and this is why I say, like, I'm with my clients, I'm very big on, your pain is actually trying to help you. It's just a little bit misguided. And so if we can use it in a constructive way to help you, it would be great. I remember that, you know, that senior year of college onset, I was seeing somebody seriously, like dating somebody, and we were about to graduate and it was going to become a long distance relationship. And we were at this point of like, you know, are we going to continue this? You know, are we going to look at engagement possibly, or, you know, break up? And I started to see how kind of throughout my dating career, my pain would help me. Like, you know, I think my pain was at that time, you know, about not wanting to be in that relationship and wanting to end it and wanting to, you know, but feeling like I couldn't, feeling like I had to make him happy. Or, you know, I would joke around with people that, you know, because over the, some of the relapses also weren't back. It was, you know, GI issues or even just nausea sometimes. And so my body would kind of, it was a good indicator to me about what my desire was that I was disconnected from. And in that way, I think, you know, it could be an ally. But, One thing that happened also was when I went into private practice and, you know, I was facing, like actualizing my dreams, let's say. I was about to, that's always what I wanted, was to be a therapist in private practice and then to be able to become a TMS therapist. And as that was about to happen, I had the most horrible attack of back pain that just would not go away. And that's actually the first time that I saw a TMS therapist. And I actually went to go see Dr. Fran Summer Anderson in New York. And, you know, that was another level of, you know, just learning so much about myself. And, you know, so, and after that, like, I can't remember any significant relapse. Like, I can't remember the last time I really had, you know, TMS pain.
What were some of the things that you learned about yourself? I feel like that moment of going to meet with that therapist and the series of events that happened while you were going through that with them is pretty pivotal in your story. What were some of the ones, if you don't mind sharing, some of the ones that come to mind?
Well, I remember something that happened in my first session with Dr. Summer Anderson that really still stands out to me and also became a really big learning point in the therapy that I do with others. And that was, you know, before I went to go see her, you know, I was very well networked, I'd say, in the therapy world because I was, you know, I was a therapist myself. And I went to go see people that didn't identify as TMS therapists, but I thought they were competent enough that I could take, you know, their work and join it with what I knew about TMS and it would help me. And I remember going to one guy and he said to me, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't be a therapist. Maybe it's just not for you. You know, a lot of people burn out. And I was like, I mean, that just, you know, spun me around. Like, you know, my back started killing so much more because this was my whole dream and he was taking it away from me. But not only that, it didn't match with what I felt in my gut, which was like, no, I am meant to do this and I could do it well. Like, what do you mean don't do it? So that wasn't working. I went to see somebody else and she was trying to convince me how, like, you know, the guy that I was dating was affecting me and all these things. And then I said to her, I'm like, look, you know, the more I see you, the more my back starts to hurt. I think I might need to see somebody who specializes in TMS. And she said to me, I know about that. I can help you. And then the next session, she said to me, well, did you ever try one of those like salon pause packs? Like they work really well. And I was like, oh no. And that just made my back, you know, kill so much more because I felt so helpless. I felt so alone. And then I remember my first visit with Dr. Summer Anderson. So I'm going through like everything that could potentially, and this speaks again to that point we said before. I was going through all the stuff that was going on in my life and all the things that it could potentially be and what could I be repressing, you know, of the things that are happening or the emotions that I'm having. And she just cut in and she said to me, like, wow, you must always be thinking. She's like, your mind just seems like it's always on overdrive. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes. Yep. Yes, it is. And it was such a relief to hear somebody say that, because that was actually what I needed to hear. It wasn't about any of the actual details of my life at the time that I was like going through with other therapists that I had tried. It was just that I was so overthinking, so overanalyzing, being so hard on myself about things. And I just needed to like chill out, you know? I just needed to be more trusting, more patient, more. And when she, and that's what I mean also about pointing out defenses. When she made me see that what was really hurting me was my overactive mind, and I was able to put that in perspective, I was like able to calm down. And that's when the pain started to go away. So
it's interesting. I interviewed somebody not long ago that she teaches mm-hmm. What's called the three principles, and I haven't mm-hmm. delved too deep into this stuff, but her entire philosophy, I mean, she had a broken neck, she had a variety of things, and she has done like trauma support in Israel. And her entire theory on TMS cessation of pain and really eliminating symptoms comes down to thought, basically allowing thoughts to control us. And that sounds a lot like what you're talking about, is this, you know, this over anxious mind, this one that's kind of always running on overdrive, going. And I think that maybe the natural response for somebody, if they were to hear that, were to say, oh, well, you know, meditate for 5 minutes or do some breathing exercises, which so many people have tried ad nauseum for a long time. Right. And they still have a lot of these problems. So what is the difference? How did you manage to slow that thinking down versus, you know, trying a lot of these external things that a lot of people try for a long time, whether it's yoga or meditation or anything like that? Because those don't seem to be longstanding solutions to the problem.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I'm very, very honest with my clients, and it's very hard for me to recommend things that haven't worked well for me.
Yeah.
So I'll sometimes say, you know, people say that meditation can be very helpful, but I never found that for myself. So I can't tell you that for sure.
Right.
I mean, I have to tell you, I think that I'm sure you've probably heard this in other contexts, but, self-compassion is a really big thing. I think that a lot of people with TMS are very critical of themselves, very hard on themselves, set unrealistic expectations for themselves. And I think that the mind, you know, is another way of doing that. And it's also another way of disconnecting from your emotions. So I would say two things. One is increasing the self-compassion, which becomes a big part of the therapy, but, you know, it can also be worked on your own. But also I think, you know, what we say, like going into the body, you know, if your mind is very active, it's helpful to go into the body. And the way that works is, you know, well, there's two ways. Either physically, like you could search for a sensation, like let's say a tightening in the chest, or some people have like a tingling in their elbows, or, you know, and you just say, what's that sensation about? And it helps you to connect with emotions and your inner world and your emotional world, because usually that overactive mind is really just a cover up of stuff going on in your inner world, your emotional world that you're not connected to. And the other thing is, and this was something, another thing that happened in my kind of TMS therapy that helps me and I use with others, is we, you know, people who tend to live so much in their heads, I try to help them, like I call it living from their experience. So not checking in with your head so much, but checking in with the gut, so to speak, and saying, you know, how does this sit with me? You know, what is my gut telling me? Because I think a lot of this also is about like digesting emotions. Like some people say about being aware, but let's say there's always people who journal and are not having success. That's because I think you need to digest the emotion. Like you need to, you know, kind of let it pass through you, experience it, and just, you know, deal with it.
I think that's on the right track. Actually, the somatic stuff is really interesting because I feel like more and more, the more people I talk to on this podcast, the more people bring up somatic work in some way, going into the body as an example, you know, feeling mm-hmm. places of tension and trying to understand, okay, what is that particular thing connected to? I think it's interesting stuff. I do certainly want to get to the diagnosis in the 30s. So let's go there because it is something that I feel like it's brought up quite a bit. And even though, I mean, you put in parentheses that, it's not TMS. However, it sounds I'll like there's a certain connection. So go for it.
I guess the reason why I went into the other stuff was, you know, just to say that I was at a point in my life where I felt really worked through when it came to this. You know, it really wasn't a part of my life anymore. That, you know, I was dealing kind of with my own mind-body connection. I had no pain, no kind of ongoing physical symptoms. But then what you're talking about is at about, you know, I think 36, 37 or so, I was feeling this lump in my neck that wasn't going away. And I went to go check it out, and I got the shocker of a lifetime, which was I'd been diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is cancer. And then I had to go through the staging, and I discovered that I was stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma. So that was a real shock because, you know, I was in my 30s. It wasn't that I was old. There's no strong, you know, family history of cancer. And I was in a really good, healthy place in my life. Like, I was starting out my mornings with, you know, lemon ginger water for detoxifying properties and then having my green smoothie. And I had exercise and I was getting good sleep. And emotionally, I was in a good place. So that really, like, you know, shocked me. And so, you know, my immediate reaction because, and it wasn't like people were amazed at how I dealt with it, but for me, it wasn't so amazing. It actually came very naturally. My immediate reaction was, you know, okay, so what kind of perspective do I want to take on this? Like, how do I want to respond to this in addition to whatever medical care is necessary, like in my mind? And, I can't even say I try. It really came naturally just from having this as such a big part of my life. I really kind of took a mind-body approach to it. Now, I think what you were referring to before is most of the doctors, let's say, that identify as, you know, mind-body or TMS doctors will tell you cancer is not, you know, TMS or mind-body syndrome, whatever you want to call it, that emotions play a factor in, you know, cancer and definitely a factor in recovery from cancer. But as opposed to, you know, classical TMS, it's not the 100% cause. And, you know, working your emotions won't necessarily make it go away either. So I did do chemo for 6 months. But I mean, I did it for 6 months because the doctor required me to do it for 6 months. But actually, my first scan, which was 2 months in, I was already declared cancer free. So I went from a stage 4 to cancer free in a very short period of time. And I really credit that. I mean, thank God, but I really feel that, you know, taking a mind-body approach made the world of a difference.
It's interesting. Dr. Gabor Mate in his book talks about, he's really the only person in this space, at least of the books that I've read on the topic, that makes that actually makes that leap to say that there is a certain connection. He talks a lot about MS. He talks a lot about breast cancer. He talks about other kinds of cancer. And the people in my life that have been diagnosed seem like they would be really, really high on like the ACE score. But haven't delved in really into any sort of like day-to-day stuff. Not the people that I know anyway, unless it was like really, really pushed down, you know, kinds of things.
Right.
So I guess like, I don't know. It's interesting. Again, like it's not something that's ever mentioned in the book, stuff like that. What do you think it is about? Because I think there's two trains of thought that people are listening to this are going to say, oh, well, she means to think positive during recovery. And so that ultimately helped her recover. Is that what you mean? Or do you mean something else?
Not necessarily. There was that too. But there were times that I did that it didn't, you know, you could set yourself up for major disappointment if you rely on that. Because I remember when I was waiting for the staging and things like that, I was like, oh, it's going to be fine. And then I get like the worst possible stage ever, you know. So I mean more of, you know, when I said the way that I discovered the cancer was feeling this, you know, lump in my neck, I felt totally normal. I felt totally fine. It's, you know, I didn't feel sick. So immediately I made the decision, I'm not going to become sick now just because they told me that I am.
Yep.
If I feel healthy and normal, I'm going to be healthy and normal. I'm going to treat this because that's the responsible thing to do. You know, there is something that needs treatment in my body, but I'm not going to, I'll put it this way. The associations that people had with cancer, I didn't want to make any of those associations. I wanted to be, I have to go through chemo now. There are certain things I need to do for my health, but I'm going to still see myself the same way I was up until now, to the point where I kept my cancer secret. I basically told only the people that I really have to tell because they were they're in my day-to-day life, but I didn't tell a lot of people, and I kept it secret because I didn't trust that other people could have the reaction that I wanted to have, and I didn't want that crowding out my experience of it. So it was more than just, I'm going to be fine. I just, you know, I wouldn't allow myself to become a cancer patient and all the things that you picture coming with that. I wouldn't even use the word cancer. I would say my Hodgkin's. I wouldn't use chemo. I would say treatments. Like it's really about the associations with these things because, you know, where your mind is, that's what I think my whole experience kind of taught me is your mind really creates your reality. And if I saw myself as healthy, I would respond healthfully. And I was I hardly ever felt sick. I did very well in my chemo sessions. I think I missed, well, I cut down my work week to a shorter week, but I missed one day of work in 6 months of chemo. Like I was really living mostly my normal life. And I think because I saw myself as normal.
Two quotes come to mind, or two discussions come to mind. When Dr. Schumacher has talked about, he calls it the danger alarms, but basically like if something happens or you get a feeling or a tweak in your back or whatever, if those danger alarms turn on, that's only going to lead to more problem. And the other thing, and kind of like related, unrelated, but Nicole Sachs, who's so monumental in this space, she had this quote on a YouTube video once where she said, listen, if I sit around and I think of myself as a piece of shit all the time, then that's probably what I'm going to be. And so if you would have sort of stopped and thought, okay, I'm going to be, you know, my hair's going to be gone. And excuse my ignorance. I don't know anything about this stuff. Right. But, my hair's going to be gone. I'm going to be throwing up in this side and I'm going to be too weak to walk and all that kind of stuff. That could have very well been where you were headed.
And I did lose my hair and that is traumatic.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's not like nothing was bad, but I try not to label it, you know, that way. And like I would wear makeup to chemo every time because I wanted to feel good. I wanted to, you know, if I have this beanie on my head or whatever, I didn't want to look awful. I would just, when I was in my chemo sessions, I would focus on like the nurses were so nice. And I would talk to them and I would just be like, so it feels great to be surrounded by all this goodness, you know, people doing good things with their life. Like that's where I would put my attention. instead of like, oh, I have to do, you know, this horrible thing.
And, right.
And there's also this crazy thing that happened that, you know, I really feel like I should share with you. Because I don't believe in coincidence. To me, everything has meaning. So this felt like a little, if you want to call it like a God wink or something. Once I was there getting my treatments, and ironically, actually, I got treated at NYU Hospital, which is where Dr. Sarno used to work. And it was in the building where his practice would have been, like the building that Dr. Rochbaum was actually located in, who took over his practice. And once I, you know, am going on a pee break and, you know, I'm wheeling out my my chemo thing that I'm hooked up to and walking through the hallway. And I look ahead of me and I was like, no, there's no way. And I'm say, Dr. Sarno? And the man turns around and sure enough, it was Dr. Sarno.
That's so
cool. Ran into him. This was only like 4 or 5 months before he died. So I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know what he was there for. I think, you know, he may have been going on his way to a doctor's appointment of his own or something, but I got to talk to him and I said to him, you know, he saw that obviously I was there for something major and I had told him, you know, I had Hodgkin's lymphoma and I said, but I'm doing great. And I really feel like it has to do with where my mind is all because of you. And to me, to run into him, like, as I'm going through this, it'd been years since I had seen him and several months before he died. To me, that was just like confirmation. You're on the right track, girl. You know, like this, you know, where your mind is really is huge.
Yeah. Right. Did you see the, you know, that incident and what happened? Was it just a random piece of fate? There was a quote that you had in the email that you sent me where you had said, something about treating symptoms as a medical issue, but not as like rather than an mm-hmm. indication of your emotional health. Is there anything, any part of you that would be led to believe that being diagnosed with that and being so far along stage 4, mm-hmm. by the time that you even got word of it, do you think that that had really anything to do with your, with the barometric pressure of your emotional world, if you will?
I'm not sure what you mean.
So Sarno a lot of times would say people's symptoms, yeah. Of, you know, back pain or whatever it is that they have is really a barometer of their emotional world, like their internal emotional
right.
world. So do you see any correlation in your own life when you think up to those, you know, to that happening, that diagnosis that, hey, maybe
do I think that was a manifestation?
Yeah.
The cancer was a manifestation.
Right. Or even something that pushed it towards that side of the needle.
I think in all cases of cancer, there's something that pushes it to that side of the needle. And, you know, because, everybody has cancer cells in their body. And so it's got to look at, you know, so who does it develop for and who doesn't it? And I think that emotions and state of mind, for sure play a role in that. And that's why I say for me, you know, I'm sure my emotional world, played somewhat of a role. I don't even necessarily think it was the dominant role, but definitely played a role in me getting it, but played a huge role in how I fared through it and what my results were. I think both.
It's a hard left turn, but one thing that just came to mind, especially because you work with people that are TMS and then you work with people who probably have no idea even what TMS is.
Right.
I would imagine you probably work with them both. I asked Dr. Schubiner, hey, you know, of all the, say you see 100 patients, how many of those are coming to you to see you for TMS? And he had said there's so much screening now to see him that it's just about everybody, it sounds like.
100%.
But say that you have 10 people who you're working with, how many of those are coming to you because of a longstanding pain issue?
It varies over time, but I would say the majority. I would say if it's out of 10, then 7 or 8.
Wow. Okay. And, are there certain, I know you've talked a lot in this interview about personality traits and commonalities between them. What are some of the, like for me now, after doing this, particularly in doing this podcast for the last 2 years, but even just learning things about myself, I can kind of sit here and I do this a lot and maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, but I just sort of armchair quarterback different people that I know. And it's almost like, yeah, that person's got it. That person's got it. That person's got it. Because I start to see these character and personality traits that seem like they all have them in common. Are there certain, you know, a certain two or three that you find far more prevalent occur in these people? I know you talked about people pleasers earlier, perfectionist, things like that.
Right.
But these answers tend to also vary. I remember Dr. Feinblatt had a theory that she had said that she sees a lot of people that have some kind of a learning disability, as an example, early on in life.
Oh, interesting.
So for you and your experience, where have maybe a small handful of those lied where it's like, this is kind of the dominant couple or three personality traits that you have that would identify TMS for you?
I see a lot of rigid thinking, I call it, amongst my clients. Not a lot of flexibility in response. There's just this one thing that has to happen and then they'll be happy, or then, they'll feel okay. Or a lot of independence, or like a fixation on independence. Like, I'll say, like, I just got a call last week from a potential client, and I could hear their TMS, and that always happens, but I could hear their TMS just in their conversation with me in the first phone call, because it was like, well, you know, I started the journaling and I just watched this YouTube. Like, he was so bent on pushing it off, saying, maybe I don't have to start with you yet. You know, maybe later, like, I can do this on my own. And I said to him, you know, I respect that and that's totally fine with me. I said, but what I'm noticing in what you're saying is that, like, this is like the therapy would be a bad thing to be avoided, you know, but do you ever think about that it's giving to yourself? Like, do you ever think about that this is treating yourself? It's giving yourself something special. Like, wow, I'm allowing myself to have this space, this safe place to heal, to be heard, to be seen. And it's actually a gift. It's actually something that could be desirable or good. And I see a lot of that people, like, you know, they can tough it out, muscle through it, you know, and that's why I said before that self-compassion piece, you know, very kind of tough on themselves, or hold themselves to very high expectations, or deny themselves a lot. I see that a lot, denial of good, of giving to themselves, things like that. So one thing I go over a lot with my clients is and, not or, that, you know, let's say that black and white kind of thinking I see very often. So I try to help them with, you know, replace that or with and. Another thing, and I'll kind of connect these two, is people, you know, and this is kind of TMS 101, I go over this in the very beginning, but that feelings and actions are two separate things. Feelings you really have no choice over. They're there whether you want them or not. It's just a matter of if you acknowledge it. But when it comes to actually decisions, that's where your choice comes in. So a lot of people, let's say you're having a relationship that is causing them some distress, but they don't want to face it because then they think they have to do something about it that they don't want to do. So let's say they're having marriage trouble, or, you know, disappointed with their choice of spouse, or, you know, not feeling the love or whatever, but they don't want to necessarily think about getting divorced. So they don't want to look at it. They don't want to talk about it, because then that means they have to get divorced. So I've said to people, you can hate your spouse and still stay married. Like, you know, that's another choice, but it kind of makes it safe to have those scary feelings. And, you know, another common kind of TMS patient is new parents, but it could be parents at any stage, you know, to normalize, hey, it's normal to feel like sometimes, you know, you wish you could run away, or you wish you didn't have all this responsibility, or you wish you could be free. Like, don't be afraid of that feeling. It makes you normal. You don't have to run. You don't have to just because you feel that way. So I try to, you know, that's what I mean by and instead of or, like, you know, you could hate this person and still be with them.
It's funny you say that, because becoming a new parent unequivocally took away my my ability to eat ice cream for like 5 years until I realized, oh, the timing of that's really strange. And then this food allergy that seemingly came out of nowhere also disappeared equally as fast.
Wow.
And it coincided so well with that. And, you know, there's a TMS doctor in Nashville, Dr. Alicia Batson, who she said that she tested positive for like 16 or 17 food allergies or something. And she worked with a pain psychologist at the Pain Psychology Center in Beverly Hills, and all those are gone now. And actually, her medical opinion is that pretty much anything but celiac disease, she had said, is probably like 99% a TMS issue or a mind-body issue. And it certainly was in my case. I want to go back to that, the divorce talk that you were talking about, you know, because there are so many instances where people feel stuck, and it could be something as small as, I don't even have a small, but I feel like maybe dealing with the heavier one is bigger. So if we said it was a divorce or a kid, like a, you know, a child that you don't, not that you don't like, but that, that kind of stuff.
That you wish
circumstances were different. And I think so much of the reason that people don't want to, that they try and push this like think positivity thing, is that like they really have sort of these feelings, but if they don't, but if they think about something, so much of our culture is about solving problems. And so if we're very frustrated with our job and we hate our job, we assume that means we need to quit our job. And I made that mistake really early on in reading. And actually it ended up being a good thing that I quit this job. But in the moment, it was kind of like, read Sarno's book, reevaluated my life for 3 or 4 weeks, and quit my job that I'd been at for almost a decade on a whim.
Wow.
And it turns out that, like, maybe it wasn't the best decision at the moment, but, but you know, whatever. And so talk a little bit more through that about, you know, I guess like people having negative thoughts or, you know, negative disposition towards something. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do something about it. Can you just elaborate more on that?
Yeah. I've even with clients sometimes like encourage them to kind of laugh at their pain or laugh at their problems, like to say so what to it, like to de-arm it, like not make it as big as they're making it out to be. So, let's say somebody loses their job. Oh, you lost your job. Like, so what? Obviously you need to deal with it. It is a big deal, but I'm saying to, you know, to take the emotional piece off of it that feels like a threat. You know, what's the worst thing that can happen? You know, can it be managed? You know, what are the chances that you really can't find anything? You know, like, but I think it's, you know, that the so what piece is a really big piece. Like, just making it less scary, making it more normal, more manageable. You know, people just, they feel like it's not rational, but a lot of times it's like an emotional response. I'm trying to think, like, I think of an example to make it more clear, but I don't know if that makes sense at all.
No, it definitely does. It for sure does, actually. And it's something I feel like I talk a lot about on this podcast. And that's something that I think, like, a lot of the block and a lot of the stumbling block when I talk to people that have that they don't really get anywhere with something like journaling or introspection or whatever, tends to be that maybe they're going too light on, like, basically on whatever the situations are. And I think that maybe the reason that that is the case is that they do have the assumption that they have to change whatever it is that they're talking or writing about. I think that even maybe deeper in that is that they're a perfectionist and they're somebody who always does what they say they will do and they're noble and all this kind of stuff. And I think those are all TMS personality traits. So it's basically telling a lie, which a perfectionist wouldn't do. It's basically telling a lie if they write, "I hate my spouse," if they don't go as far as like divorce them. Does that make sense?
That it's I see what you're saying.
That they can't bring themselves to even say something negative, because if they say something negative, it means they have to do something about it, because that's what a perfectionist would
do. That's why, like, you know, it's like groundbreaking news when I tell them you could hate somebody and still stay married to them. Like, it never even occurred to them, but that is a choice. Like, it is up to you. You can't, you know, that's why I say the feeling is not a choice, but the decision is. Plenty of people are staying in unhappy marriages. If that's what you want, you can, you know, and then you, once they calm down, you can start looking at, well, is there room for it to get better? Is there room for improvement? And maybe there is, and maybe there isn't, but either way, you can still stay married to them if you want to stay married to them. It really is up to you, you know?
It seems like so much of your work, it's a little different than a lot of the psychotherapists that I've talked to, that it seems so layered, and that there's, you know, it's almost like, and I'm totally putting words in their mouth, but say that they were to work with somebody for, I need a number that's divisible by four. Let's say 8 months. Say they're going to work with somebody for 8 months. And, you know, the first 2 months we're going to spend working on this particular thing or part of it. And then the next 2 months we're going to work on this particular thing of it. It seems like that your methodology is far more rooted in we just need to get you to a place of safety, empowerment, and learning that you're moving at 100 miles an hour and you don't need to be.
Right. I mean, we talked before about why do I do this work. I love personal growth. I love transformation. I love, fulfillment. And, I want people to have that experience working with me. You know, when I say I do therapy and TMS therapy, I like therapy and what it can do. So I want it to actually be a therapeutic experience. I'm not very do this and then do that. It's more relational. And actually, I'm remembering now that when you asked, what kind of patterns do I see amongst my clients, that's a big piece. You get a lot of people who, no parent is perfect. Every parent messes up somewhere. But let's say they had a pretty critical parent, and so now they're critical on themselves. But even people who have a whole family, but a lot of aloneness. And I feel like a lot of the healing, and when they're able to, because I see TMS and a bunch of people talk about it this way as a defense. So what helps them to drop the defense is feeling deeply seen, deeply heard, appreciated for who they are. Like that's all the relational stuff that I try to offer people in my work, is alleviating some of the aloneness that they feel like down to their core.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we are approaching the end here, and I think this stuff has been really fascinating. What sort of closing comments or remarks before we get into where people can find you and work with you, learn more about you and some of your methods and things like that, methodology. Are there any sort of if they want to walk away from this interview, what should they remember and what should they know that's critical to how it is that you believe?
Interesting. I think that piece that I said about digesting the feelings, perhaps because this happens to so many perfectionistic types, and I was saying before, people who have kind of rigid thinking, they can overwork these things. So I think what I was saying about the relational piece and the digesting the feelings, I didn't like using the word learning because I feel like that's even too active, but just allowing things to be, making them not so scary. I think a lot of people lose the pain when they stop being afraid of it. I think Dr. Schubner is big on that. But he might take more of a technical thing with that. But I think when you get to a place of just having trust in yourself, trust in life, trust in the universe, comfort with imperfections, being an imperfect person, your life being imperfect, it really comes from this just kind of calm, okay feeling inside. And then the pain or illness can kind of just drop to the side because you don't need it anymore. I think underneath that pain sometimes is just this kind of nervous reaction of, I'm not okay, I'm not okay, I'm not okay. I need something, I need something, I need something. So just being able to kind of relax from the inside out helps you, drop that pain.
That is very Schubner-esque, by the way.
right.
Because there was a person, I did a very short Q&A with him, and there was somebody who had asked, I think they said they were in, I think it was 2 years of pain or 3 years of pain. He started to, and that they journal every single day, and are they too far gone? Are they going to remain in pain forever because they've been too far gone? And actually, this guy's in Jersey, so he's not too far from where you were. Schubner talked about this patient he had who had debilitating pain for 37 years, and he said, you've probably unearthed really everything you're going to unearth. There's not really anything left to write in a journal.
Right.
And so he's most likely probably what's going to happen or the best course of action for you is once you can actually get to a point of indifference and not caring, that there's no reason for it to be there and it will just go away. But I understand right. It's a very difficult place to get to as well.
Right. But I think Dr. Schubner focuses it more on like not caring about having the symptoms.
Right.
And I think maybe I'm talking more on a more deeper emotional level, like when I was saying the so what piece, like just not being afraid of what's happening in your life, not being afraid of your feelings. You know, I guess taking the Schubner idea to a deeper, more emotional, psychological level.
Yep.
And I would just say one other thing is, you know, Dr. Sarno was very big on the pain going in trends. So when, you know, he started writing his books, back was big. Then he would say, you know, when computers got big, carpal tunnel got big. And, you know, it goes in trends. And actually, you know, my theory is we're now seeing it show up as anxiety and depression. You know, anxiety and depression have become big keywords. And I think that's kind of like the next step for the TMS movement is to see how depression and, you know, people think of it as causing the TMS, but I think it can become another manifestation of TMS, like, you know, rumination becoming another way of blocking out, you know, emotions or, you know, just areas of your life that want to be engaged, want your attention. My other piece.
It's a whole
to
other,
look out for.
Yeah, it's a whole other conversation for another day. But the if we would have said it 25 minutes ago, we could have really drilled into the seasonality and the different, you know, the ulcers at one point in time and the
right.
back pain and the neck pain and then the depression, anxiety.
Right.
There was something somebody said recently. She does a podcast, and I don't even know sometimes why I even listen to it because very like. Kind of foul mouthed, a little immature, you know, very, I don't know, over the top a lot of times. But sometimes I'm like, yeah, that was pretty funny. Like, I don't know. It's a little humorous to me. Some of the stuff that she talks about, but she was talking about this new, and I've talked to a couple of people that either have thought maybe they had this or they've at least discussed it is there's this thing that I start seeing a little bit more headlines about with like breast implant illness. And she had said in her podcast, again, it's not a TMS thing. I doubt she's ever even heard of any of this stuff, but it was something she started seeing on social media, talked about a ton. And she had said that it's really just another way for you to ignore the anxiety in your life. And I was like, ooh, like that's
right.
like how wild that that thought is that now, at least on social media, seems to be something that's popping up a ton. But one thing that I've done on when I see it talked about is I'll click into like that person's Instagram as an example, and I'll start scrolling back and I'll see, oh, 2 years ago they went all vegan because they had a skin issue that they thought would be solved
right.
by that. And then 3 years before that they had a back fracture and they were out of the gym. And then 3 years before, you know what I mean? So it's like I can kind of see this patterning. That's more armchair quarterbacking, and I'm not a doctor and I'm not a shrink, and I sort
right.
of and but, I, yeah so
yeah and what I would also see in that is here's some, you know, saying about denial before, is somebody that's denying themselves pleasure, you know, like they keep finding ways to like cut out things in their life is like saying I'm not worth it.
Yeah.
Like they're not allowing themselves to enjoy things, to relish things, and you know there's more to that.
Yep Liz, this has been awesome. Where can people find you to learn more about you and maybe potentially work with you if they like what you're about?
Sure. Thank you. So I have a website, LizWallensteinTherapy.com. I put a lot of information on there as well as, you know, posts about different ideas, topics. And then I have a Facebook page. I don't remember the exact name, but probably if you just kind of look at Liz Wallenstein Therapy, you would find it. Or you go to my website, there'll be a link to it. And on my website will also be a link to my Instagram account. It's a new account, so not much on there yet, but it's growing. And I would say, yeah, those are the places. I also have a YouTube channel, not much on there, but that will also grow within, you know, the next few months.
Cool. And I'll link to all this stuff in the show notes. So if you want to be able to find Liz, you can easily click on show info, regardless of the platform you're on. You can click on the links to see the different things. So it will be there.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, Liz.
This is great. Thank you.